Blog Talk Radio.
Do you know God has called you? Do you know your purpose? Let us help you get on cue.
I learned more about the heart of leadership than the art of leadership. What Eric Powell does in this session is make the leader in you come alive.
Welcome to the show. You're listening to On Cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. Thanks for joining us. Friends, no matter if you are the president or the pastor or a soldier or a songwriter, no matter the role, you have a purpose and you're a leader in that purpose. And our goal here is simple, to inspire and equip all to lead where they are. In other words, get us on cue with God's will, on cue with his calling on our lives, which is our purpose, and get on others on cue with that purpose. Now, what is cue? It is how Nehemiah, a model transformation leader, led a starved, desperate, broken people in building a wall and building a way of life in ancient Jerusalem. He CUE'd them up. C is for common ground. It's what we can agree on. Is it really the why we've come together? U is unified thought. What vision can we share? It's the what we plan to do. And E, equally yoked, it is what's the game plan? What's success look like? What's my role in it? It's how do we work together? It's the how. So cue leadership in a broad sense, integrate biblical principles of leadership using Nehemiah as a model, but helping you to do two things. One, to get people to trust you, and two, get people to follow you in discipleship. And those two elements, trust and discipleship, is at the very axis of leadership, no matter what frame of mind or sphere of influence you're a part of. So as we always do, we want to start our show with our prayer. So, Lord, you are merciful, powerful, loving God. We thank you for this day. Lord, lead and bless this ministry and our audience and all that are serving you, Lord. So we know that this cue leadership is your brainchild, but our calling in your name. We honor you today by doing two things, by giving you the glory and serve this generation through cue. So, Lord, your word in Romans 12:2 tells us, be not conformed to this world, but be ye transformed by renewing of your mind, that you may prove what is good and acceptable and perfect will of God. So, Lord, use this ministry to complete that purpose, to align and equip and transform some new leaders for your glory, and help others hear the call, receive the call, and, Lord, use this to raise some transformation leaders, some gatekeepers. In Christ's name we pray. Amen. All right. As we always do, our show is a lot of things. We like to have a dialogue. We like to have a dialogue, a conversation about leadership based in God's word. We try to equip leaders with a roadmap to tap into those two elements of building faith and building trust and build discipleship using faith. Highlight everyday leaders who are making a difference. They can testify to God's goodness and glory. And our show is a lot of things, but our show is not. It is not to criticize, but shine a light on some truth, but in love. It's not to tell you what to do, but provide a different lens in order to see things. And it's not to focus on the mere symptoms of a problem, but at the root of the problem. In a sense, treat the infections, not necessarily a running nose. So today's within a day. Let's be open. That we hear the Lord and not me and have the right questions no matter what the differences may be. Remember that this life is about love and surrender, and there may be differences of things. When they are, let us do what a true transformation leader says. Let us agree without being disagreeable. And at the end of the day, be thought partners and have a fruitful dialogue to solve some of the things that we're talking about over these next few series.
So today, our nation – our world, in a sense, our nation is a young nation compared to the most in the world, but it has a rich history. No matter what our perspectives are, we agree that is rich, but with a legacy that is still being crafted, in a sense. When I think about that rich history, naturally I think about leaders who sacrifice much for the next generations. And people that come in mind, number one, of course, is Christ as the ultimate sacrifice. Others, my parents, their parents, those that fought the rights for those less fortunate and oppressed. And one of my all-time historical favorites, you know, someone like a Frederick Douglass. You know, if you haven't read Fred, please do whenever you can. And then from the biblical perspective, you think about, you know, Moses. You know, Moses, who all we think about is God's chosen to lead his people out of Egypt's bondage. You know, there's Moses of another color and gender, if you will, Harriet Tubman, and this, which is the subject of what our conversation is about today. She's perhaps one of the most well-known of all the Underground Railroad conductors. During a two-year span, if you recall, she made the perilous trips to the slave South 19 times by 1960, and including one especially challenging journey, which she rescued her 70-year-old parents. She became known as the Moses of during that time, and I can recall Frederick Douglass writing, especially excepting for John Brown of A Sacred Memory, "I know no one who has willingly encountered more perils and hardships to serve our enslaved people than Harriet Tubman." And as she once proudly pointed out to Frederick Douglass, all her journeys, she never lost a single passenger. And, you know, the amazing thing, she did this with a $40,000 bounty on her head. $40,000 in the 1860s. In 2012 dollars, it's $1,007,397.43. That's some more. I got to calculate earlier this week. That's pretty significant. A $1 million bounty on your head for 10 years. And Terry, of course, she was courageous and service and resolute and really truly transformational during that time. But I don't know, want to lose that fact, but she didn't do it alone. It could be a topic for another show, but there are many others who sacrificed, black and mostly white, provided shelter, resources, who conducted their parts of the Underground Railroad, who led where they are. But more specifically regarding Harriet Tubman, some years back I was honored to meet a descendant of Harriet Tubman. You know, I act like a kid in a candy store because of the importance of what she did. You know, you look at today's pictures and how she characterized, and, you know, I really saw the resemblance, the high cheekbones, the piercing eyes. I saw the strength, a level of elegance, and also saw that fire in this lady. How I was able to do it, when my former business partner was from Liberia, and he grew up with the Tubman family. As you know, Liberia is the country that U.S. helped to send and settle ex-slaves who wanted to go back and have a fresh start. And some of Harriet's descendants chose to go back to Africa and start anew. You know, so he was befriended that family, and I was fortunate enough to meet some of them. Like Moses, you know, with the children of Israel, like Harriet Tubman on the Underground Railroad, and the Tubman family, literally to Liberia, you know, they were all escaping bondage, all escaping the bondage of the physical. But, you know, what about the mind and what about the spirit? You know, who today are helping free people from bondage of the mind and heart and the spirit? That's always a question for, you know, where are those modern-day Moseses? Where are those modern-day Harriet Tubmans? Thankfully, there are many. That is why On Cue and Cue Leadership exists, in a sense, to highlight them, to encourage them to stay on the rail, to go where no one else would go, shine a light on the dark past, and give people a fresh start and save some souls. You know, which leads to the question of the day: are you leading people out of bondage, or are you chaining those you lead in fear? Are you chaining those you lead in guilt of not following you? Or are you chaining those that you lead in shame? Or chaining those you lead to things that are not of God? So today we have someone who's leading people through her art. My Canadian cousin, Deanna Bowen. I call her a modern-day Harriet Tubman, even though she doesn't necessarily probably want to be tagged as that, but she's really just serving. You know, her work tells a story of my great-great uncle, who led his own railroad from the plantations in Butler County, Alabama, to Canada around the 1900s, and whose work united our families, American family, with our Canadian family. And her work is also leading people out of bondage of a dark past of regret and shame, fear, to really want to love a fellowship and family and understanding. So after the break, we will bring on the Moses. We will bring on the modern-day Harriet Tubman, De'Aaron Bowen. So stay with us. You can't afford to miss this story, a rich history. You're listening to On Cue. By getting them on cue with God's will, by getting them on cue with His calling on their lives. Let us help you get on cue.
How powerful is your leadership? Do people trust you? Would people follow you if you were not their boss, not their parent, not their sibling, not their commanding officer? Let us help you get on cue.
I learned more about the heart of leadership than the arch of leadership. What Eric Powell does in this session is makes the leader in you come alive.
Do you know God has called you? Do you know your purpose? Let us help you get on cue.
It should be a mandatory part of every church pre-membership class, every school leadership program. I think this curriculum effectively used not only positions the person for better leadership, but positions the person for better life.
And we're back. You're listening on cue on FaceTime Radio. I'm your host, Eric Powell. You know, our mission here is to get us on cue with God and His purpose, to equip leaders to lead where they are. You know, follow us on Twitter at Cue Leadership. Email us with questions or comments and whatever on your hearts at onq@cueleadership.org. You know, you may be asking, you know, Eric, how do you have generations of Canadian-born cousins? I asked myself that too once I found out, but it's truly because of some Moses, some Harriet Tubman decided to help lead a people out of bondage. But let me share that. It began with my mom some years ago visiting us in Dallas over Thanksgiving, and leave it to my mom knowing people and knowing people from all over the place. And if you know her, you know what I mean and understand. So she wanted to call up our cousins who live in Dallas. And I remember saying, you know, cousins, what cousins? She said, honey, you know, you have a whole set of folks that live here. And Ty and I, of course, have been here for almost 5 years at that point. And but so, you know, come to find out, I have not just one to two cousins, but I have, you know, generations of people here in Dallas, from Canada, Darley, Aunt Cleo, and from Fairfield area, Oklahoma, Missouri, all the way to Canada. You know, now you even brace yourself. I can't believe I'm admitting this on air, but even a movie star, we all will know that is also part of our family, come to find out, and it's my first time saying this, but Samuel L. Jackson, you know, again, a rich history, right? And got a chance to meet his aunts and people to help, raise him in Missouri, and it's just phenomenal rich history that we found. It's all because of my host that's coming on. You know, it didn't come to life until I met Deanna, you know, who's on her journey, if you will, to the South, to discover the story of her people and our people, and you know, through her own documentary, you know. So let's welcome my cousin, my sister, my good friend, Deanna Bowen. Deanna, are you on? Absolutely. So, can you hear us here? I can't hear it all. Deanna? Okay, well, great. We're sorry for the technical difficulties here, and hopefully everyone can hear you as well. So Deanna, thanks for taking the time this morning, and I know that you got a lot of things on your agenda today, but we'll get right to it, right?
Yeah, thank you for having me.
Of course. So I know that you're modest and wouldn't necessarily characterize yourself as a modern day Harriet Tubman. So how would you describe yourself using just one word?
Artist.
Artist.
I would say I'm an artist. Yeah, the Harriet Tubman thing.
Can you hear? Yeah.
Just out here doing my thing, and I share. Yeah. Artwork with other people. It just happens to be about our family history.
Right, exactly. Go ahead.
Yeah.
Go ahead. And you're done?
Artist.
Okay, and so, you know, what do you want people to know about you? Did we lose her? I think we lost her. So could you just hold for a second, guys? Let's try to get her back on. And so let's continue. You know, so Deanna met her in probably 03 or 04. And so what we'll do is, you know, in order to make we should get a good get the story like we need to. So why don't we just go to a break real quick, and we'll come right back so we can get her back online so that we can have this fruitful dialogue. So you listen to On Cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. Stay tuned.
One day when heaven was filled with his praises, one day when sin was as black as could be, Jesus came forth to be born of a virgin, dwelt among men, my example is he. The word became flesh, and the light shined among us, his glory revealed. Living he loved me, dying he saved me, the very Lord.
God.
And we're back to On Cue on FaceTime Radio. Thanks for joining us, and thanks for allowing us to get through some technical difficulties and getting this call connected today. So Deanna, can you hear us?
Yep.
Awesome. And so we asked the initial question of how would you describe yourself in one word? And your answer was
artist.
And so along with that, what do you want people to know about you starting off?
I'm a big suck. I'm an artist, but it's so many other things. And why I made the joke about being a big suck is I do this genealogy work, tracing my own family history, and then out of that, I just can't help but share it with other people. It turns into all these other things. So I guess I'm part historian, part activist, part educator, part artist, part researcher, maybe a bit of healer in there as well.
Mm-hmm.
Whole bunch of things, I guess.
Whole bunch of things, So you're really proving out this whole Harriet Tubman element. I know you don't necessarily like, but you're proving it out for me, right? So a little bit more. So where did you grow up, and essentially, what do you do for a living? Just to give the audience some context.
Okay, I grew up in Vancouver. I'm American born. I was born in Oakland, California. My father's side is all from Louisiana. My mom, born in Canada, but I was raised in Vancouver with my grandparents for the most part. And they are, they were first born in Canada from two families that were ultimately from the South. My grandfather's side was from Kentucky, and my grandmother's side is from Alabama. So I was raised in the church. I was raised in what I thought was a crazy, insular little black community in Vancouver. Everybody was related. Everybody knew everybody's business, which is pretty much what drove me to move to Toronto when I was old enough. I could not cope. And then I got homesick. I had lived in Toronto for probably 15 years, and I was missing my grandparents terribly, and I started doing this research shortly after they had passed away, basically to just stay in connection with them and try to understand who we were, what was that thing that I grew up in. And so, yeah, Canadian but American, and actually I just, like 2 weeks ago, got my Canadian citizenship. I'm 44 years old.
Wow, that is great. That is great. So you know, your history, reconnecting with your history, and I think that's really what, you know, started on your journey, as you would say. And so, you know, tell us about, you know, we'll get to the specific elements about our family, but in general, about your work and your art and the things you do, and, you know, not only just for a living, but just essentially how you express that.
For a living, I won't say it's up the middle, but it's a combination of, I teach at University of Toronto in studio art, so I teach video, a little bit of performance, a little bit of what art history, and all of that. It's a really great campus. It's mostly black, brown, yellow, red kids, and so it's all about teaching them how to tell their own stories. And then my art practice is I get paid to do this research and then put it out in the world in some way or another. So what I just finished doing a couple of weeks ago was I did a piece in Atlanta that was civil rights history, Ku Klux Klan history, all of that stuff from the 1960s, middle 1960s, and then doing it in a public way so that I can pass on the information that I've discovered around our black history to people that would never think about doing the work or doing the research. Art's a really great way of getting this message across, because people are open to art more than they are to the idea of, you know, digging around in a history book, you know?
Right. I understand. I really appreciate that. And you do. And lots of times you can always bring any type of change, any type of understanding on arts, lots of time in the middle of that, you know. So with that, tell us about your work to follow our history back to the plantations of Alabama. And, you know, you can intertwine how we connected from the Juneteenth Film Festival and those types of things. But, you know, just tell us about that. And maybe it's just starting with, you know, Willis Reese Bowen. Just articulate that for the audience so they can understand how this started and the whole movement around it.
I have to go back a fair bit. But when my grandparents died, when Mama and Daddy died, Mama left me, that's what I call my grandmother, she left me an oral history that her sister had written or given about our family history, and it was the sunniest, you know, we came from Alabama, moved to Canada, and everything was great kind of story, and it couldn't possibly be true, when Mama died, Mama and Daddy died, again, I just wanted to dig around, I wanted to be connected, so I started doing the research. And hit a roadblock. The first time was I was expecting mentally to, you know, experience like Alex Haley's roots and, you know, have this great big African experience. And it wasn't that at all. The first roadblock that I hit was discovering that we were most probably enslaved by the Cherokee Nation first. So I stopped, and then I came back another 10 years later. And that was a bit of a fluke. I emailed a cousin in Canada and said, hey, I'm doing this work. Do you know of anybody? And I wasn't expecting to get to the South at all, because the Canadian side of the family is really, quite honestly, quite tight-lipped about the family history. Everybody's kind of got their pocket of information, not too sharing. So I wasn't expecting to get what I got when I met you, which was the opposite, which was, let me tell you everything I know, which was amazing. It was an amazing thing. So I actually emailed my Canadian cousin, gave me the connection for Kennard Bowen, who is in Dallas. I hope he's listening.
I think he is.
I emailed him. We corresponded for a little bit, and I just said, hey, do you want to go on a road trip? And Ken had been to Alabama. He'd actually gone further into our family history. He's gone back beyond Alabama into Florida. But we drove down. I brought a couple of friends of mine as a film crew, and how I met you was I met Ken in Dallas, and you were doing a film festival then, and then I hung out with you over the weekend. We met a whole bunch of people over the course of that weekend, and then I came back and met Ken again, and we did the road trip down to Alabama. Now, from there, that's turned into, oh, wow, I've just been digging, and it's kind of, it's like a Pandora's box. The minute you open it, you discover one connection, and that opens up a whole bunch of other things that you just can't quite put down because you need to finish it, right?
Right, right.
So I am now, where am I going now? I was going to tell you about this. There are all these, what I do with the material that I've got is I publish it on Ancestry.com. I make the family trees available to anybody to look at. And actually, beyond what I've done, there are family that are related that have found my family tree and then have made other connections to our family history in Alabama, which pretty much makes us all related. Anybody that was from Forest Home,
right?
We're talking about the Bowens, the Peeglers, the Powells, the Mitchells, the Gregories, all of these, the Womacks,
the Carters,
all related.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely.
All related.
So given that, you know, going back, let's talk about, you know, your great-great-grandfather, I think my great-great-uncle, who's the first to leave off the plantation, and if I got it right, it's really Reese Bowen, right?
No. How's it go? The one that came to Canada is Willis Reese Bowen.
Right.
The one that was born in Butler County, or Butler Springs, and never left is his father, Reese Bowen.
Right.
And then if you want to go even further back than that, there's another one. His father was Needham Bowen, but I haven't been able to nail that one down.
Sure.
But so, that's one family line. That's the family line that gets us into Canada. And then it's directly related, and it's how we're related. But there is also, Willis Bowen's, the one that came to Canada, his wife, her family line goes into Butler County and is tied into the Gregories, the Mitchells, the Womacks, and a whole bunch of other folks that never left.
Right.
So that's a whole other family line that I haven't even been able to get into yet.
Of course. So let's go backwards a little bit. From Canada, going back to Oklahoma, to Dallas, back to Alabama, way you want to go. If you just take the brother who left and bring us through, and kind of really talk about, you know, why did they leave Alabama, or why did they leave Texas, and why did they leave, especially around Oklahoma, and then really eventually leaving America. Can you talk about that?
What's the best way to do this? Well, I'll start with this. It took me 7 years to figure it out. I had been digging around, talking to family, and no one was giving the secret away. No one was letting me know. I was swimming around it. So here's what I've discovered. What I've discovered is that Willis Reese Bowen left Pine Flat in 1900 with Columbus Bowen, Albert Gregory, and Mary Gregory. Now, it was in Canada, how the story was told was, you know, they were looking for a better life and they wanted to be treated like human beings. And that's all true. It took me 7-8 years to discover that they most probably, we'll say that they did kill a white man and they dumped him in the river, and that's why they had to leave. Now, I don't know what that's about. I was told anything between it was a fight at a dance and then something even just more, you know, more straightforward, like they were called a name or something like that. Either which way, the story goes that they killed somebody and they had to run.
Okay.
And then they go from there to Texas, and that's where Kennard's family line comes in. And that's where it gets a bit confusing for me just on paper around the genealogy of it all, because it doesn't add up on paper. And it's not to say that it's not accurate or it's not true. There's just other things that kind of come into play when you start talking about us, I guess. So when they get to Texas, Kennard's grandfather, Ed, I think, stays there, and that family has lived on that farm since they settled. And then my great-grandfather and Columbus and Mary and Albert kept moving on to Oklahoma. Now, what doesn't make sense on paper is the names don't match. Who Willis Bowen is, as I understand him, on paper from, say, 1900, he doesn't exist before that.
Okay.
And so there's an interesting, but the names, the family names show up in different ways prior to that. So Columbus, Willis, Reese, all of these names show up, but they're differently attributed. So what my theory is that this murder or this killing took place and they switched names and moved forward.
Right, that makes sense.
Which isn't unusual, because I actually, when I met with Ken in Dallas the first time, I met with Cleo Harden. Do you know Cleo?
Yes, she passed some years back.
She passed away.
Yep.
But
absolutely.
I was really fortunate to catch up with her earlier, before that, and we had this whole wonderful conversation about how the family had changed its name quite a few times after we left out of Alabama, so it all kind of makes sense, right?
Sure. Beautiful soul.
She's
beautiful.
She was an amazing woman.
Yes, absolutely.
Beautiful woman. You know, that gives you some understanding around the shift from Alabama to Texas. And so my great-grandfather, Willis, Columbus, Albert, and Mary keep moving to Oklahoma before it was the state. And so it would have been Indian Territory when they got there around 1905 or so. No Jim Crow laws. We're talking about effectively Black Wall Street, like all of those black towns that we know about, high property values, established their own towns, their own city councils, all of that kind of stuff. That all happened on Indian Territory before it became Oklahoma the state. It became a state in 1907, and then, of course, the government introduced all the Jim Crow laws, the grandfather clause around voting, all of that kind of stuff. And I hear that the reason why our family came to Canada was because my great-grandfather was going to try and kill the governor. And the logic behind that was that we had achieved a kind of freedom and that all of a sudden it was being taken away. And I completely understand that.
Right.
And I don't think that was his idea. I think that was my great-grandmother's idea of, you know, look, we have how many children? And I think by that time they would have had 12 children or something like that. So he could have, yes, he could have gone and killed the governor, but what about the family that would be left behind?
Yes,
so,
absolutely.
So they came to Canada, and it was a bit of a mistake. All of this stuff is happening at the same time that Canada is expanding westward, really in a response to keep the states from expanding north, right? So Canada is just starting two provinces. One of them is Alberta. And what Canada wants to do is to encourage settlers to come to the country and homestead and basically create new homes, settle the west. But they had bad intel, and they didn't realize that they were putting newspaper ads in black newspapers in Clearview and all of these black towns.
I see.
So we heard about it, and it literally is a split between people that came to Canada and people that made the decision to go back to Africa. So there's the whole Marcus Garvey thing that's happening there. So that actually affects what's happening in Oklahoma. Some people did go that route. But we came to Canada, and how that happened was a few bachelors were sent to Canada to suss it out. They came back, said it was possible to do, and then groups of family members went in. They rented boxcars and came up in groups of 40, 20s, that kind of thing. And the Canadian government didn't want us, and so they didn't want to diplomatically offend the United States. They had already had this position of being the haven for blacks coming from the States. but at the same time, they really didn't want this American problem of ex-slaves.
Yeah,
so
I was going to ask you if, you know, how was it received? So another set of difficulties, right?
Yeah, definitely another set of difficulties. And there's actually this really great, there are historians, there are scholars that have been doing this work long before I have. And there's a whole pocket of research that's in Santa Barbara that talks about the depth of disappointment that the blacks from Oklahoma experienced when they tried to migrate from Canada. This historian, this guy named Charles Irby, describes the depression and the despondency in this community as being the lowest he'd ever seen. Because, I mean, you got to imagine, I mean, Canada's like the last stop. Where do you go after this?
Right, really? Right. Because even I spent some time there, and, you know, frankly, you know, in Calgary, and, of course, you connected me with my family there the last week I was there, but minus 40 is not a good temperature. You know, how did they manage to have their first black settlement in Alberta in that type of environment? I'm telling you, that's not a good temperature. That's when Celsius and Fahrenheit meet. It's not
they're
a good
not
temperature.
Playing.
Yeah.
They're not playing.
Yeah.
And we are, what we ended up settling is the northernmost black community in the country. It's way up there. It's way north. So the Canadian government, what they did, they didn't create a. Well, actually, that's not true. They did create a law. What they did is they discouraged people from coming across the border with health restrictions, money restrictions. Really, how they set it up is they created a whole bunch of false stories about black savages coming and stealing white women in the newspapers, and just created this incredible frenzy of fear and hysteria. And then on the immigration front, they just kept blocking people for things like the measles. Our family was turned away. Well, the family of 14 that was turned away because John Henry, who is my great uncle, had a broken leg. So the whole family was turned back, and basically the family stayed in Bellingham for a year until the leg settled, and then we came across separately. There's a couple of things. We had come up with another couple of other families and a couple of bachelors, so it was a boxcar full of 40 black folks that the immigration officials had met with, and so they obviously freaked out. And so we had figured out that the best strategy to get across was to split it up. So my great-grandfather Willis and John Henry came across a separate border entry point, and then the rest of the family came across on its own in White Rock. And then we met up again in Vancouver, and then ultimately we think we stayed there for 3 years and then came up to Alberta. In that time, what the Canadian government was trying to do, still trying to discourage people and have them go back to the States, black people that got sick, they just gave really lousy medical attention to. And so there are a few family members in our family line that actually died in Vancouver for entirely treatable things, just because they had lousy medical attention.
Sure.
And that's part of the reason why we ended up coming to Alberta, to Amber Valley, because great-grandpa Willis had heard that there was a black settlement in Alberta, and Jeannie, his wife, thought that we would be better off amongst black people. So that's how we ended up in Alberta. And then even then, when we got there, the newspaper clippings had been going out, and there was this frenzy about blacks coming in. So literally, you know, as they're, you know, doing their wagon train up to Alberta, you've got newspapers saying, you know, literally reporting on a day-by-day basis where people are.
Sure.
And where to track them. And then having, you know, reports in the newspaper saying, we're doing everything we can to discourage them. Now, what they were doing, the Canadian government will deny this, though it's totally documented, but what they did is they recruited Klansmen. They wouldn't have been the Klan. They weren't the Klan by the time they got to Canada, but they were basically the same ideology. They were looking for people that didn't believe in black people effectively, and encouraged them to come up, gave them free land, and settled them right next door to us. Also very publicly insisting that there was no problem and we were welcoming black people, but it wasn't true.
Wow.
So it was quite hostile. And then the other challenge on top of that is dealing with this whole facade of being welcoming. So it really was a really difficult time. When we got to Alberta, the family belongings, I mean, they had experienced tons of things. Great-grandma Jeannie had two strokes before she even left Oklahoma, 12 kids, and they still did the migration. The temperatures are ridiculous.
right.
The land that we ultimately got was not farming land. It was completely covered in bush. And then along the way, the whole family contracted body lice, and so they had to wash and burn everything, regroup, and then ultimately they got to Athabasca. And just go figure, everything, the whole warehouse went up in flames. Go figure.
Wow. So we went from Alabama to Texas to Oklahoma to Canada on the same type, in a sense, Jim Crow, same type struggle, same types of bondage, if you will, not only just from a bondage from a physical perspective, but, you know, the bondage of the mind from others of saying, you know, these people should not be here. They're not welcome. Here's why. And here's why. And it's amazing journey, isn't it?
It's amazing. It's humbling when you start thinking about your everyday struggles now.
Right.
In comparison to that, because it's night and day, the things that they experienced, and the kind of personal strength that you would, personal, spiritual, mental strength that you would have to be able to figure out how to work around that and still take care of your family, still build a homestead, all of that kind of stuff. Our family lived in an abandoned house in 40 Below until they could build their own house. And it's also about a kind of desperation. Well, not a desperation.
Right.
It's a right-mindedness, but underneath it there is a desperation, because really, where are you going to go if this isn't going to work? If you've already traveled, 4,500 miles over a number of years and established your family, at least four times over again?
Yeah.
Where else do you go except for back to Africa? That would probably be the only strategy after that.
Absolutely. So that's really why it was so important. I know this whole notion of what we're talking about today, it's essentially taking them out of some level of bondage, if it's physical, is it mental, or spiritual. And when you get to the point to where there's nothing else you can do, you have to take risk, you know, like Harriet Tubman did, right? If you kind of think about it, those are same elements, same situations, probably to more extreme, because it was more of a life of death, in both cases, life of death. But, you know, leading people out of that bondage. And so what we're going to do, we're going to take a break, and then we're going to come back and talk about that, and really kind of talk about the great time we had when your culmination of your documentary in our home, all of our hometowns, if you will, in Greenville, Alabama, some years back. And so when we come back, we'll pick that up. So after the break, we'll continue our dialogue with our modern day Harriet Tubman, Deanna Bowen. So stay with us. You can't afford to miss the rest of this rich story. If you have any questions, feel free to inbox me on Facebook. And you've been listening to On Cue, and I'm your host, Eric Powell. We'll be right back. By getting them on cue with God's will, by getting them on cue with His calling on their lives. Let us help you get on cue.
How powerful is your leadership? Do people trust you? Would people follow you if you were not their boss, not their parent, not their sibling, not their commanding officer, Let us help you get on the queue.
And we're back, and you're listening to On Cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. Thanks for staying with us. Remember, our mission is to get us on cue with God's will and His purpose, to equip others to lead where they are. Follow us on Twitter at Cue Leadership. Email us with questions or comments and whatever in your heart on cueleadership.org. We have a special guest. We'll continue some dialogue. We have our modern-day Harriet Tubman with us today, addressing the question today, are you leading people out of bondage? You know, so far, you know, we've talked about, Deanna, but we've talked about your work, and, you know, we've gone a little bit further talking about some of the trials and challenges that that our people went through. But, you know, at the end of the day, though, you had to have some strong leaders in that. And so part of what our mission, our ministry is about is highlighting some of those leaders of our past and so forth. And it starts with those who left, and those starts with those that stayed in order to really bear the challenges, if it's from the society or if it's weather or if it's not having enough food. It was an amazing feat, the journey that these people went on, right?
And at the same time, I think it's both sides of the coin, because yes, the family came to Canada and we set up this new community, but we wouldn't be having this conversation if it weren't for the people that stayed and had the strength to stay and fight the fights that they had fought. So, you know, it's a bit of a, I have to be really careful about it. Certainly on the Canadian side, there's always been this pushback around the folks that stayed. Why didn't they stay? Or why didn't they leave? Or they weren't strong enough, or whatever it is. And that's, I don't think that that's the right way to look at it. I think that the family that we both share that is from back home are incredibly strong people that I am obviously constantly inspired by, because I keep coming back to the South. I've been coming back to the South at least 2 to 3 times a year. They give me strength to do what I do in relative isolation in
right.
Canada, right?
Right.
You know? They are my inspiration, my leaders, and they are everyday people. Your mom, your aunt are hugely important people in my life as far as how to go about dealing with the difficulties of everyday life.
Absolutely.
Dealing with race, all this other stuff, and doing it with grace, you know?
it's amazing, you know, what the strength of those two ladies you talked about. You know, I want to pick up one, and I need, you know, I just want to tell the audience, and we'll get into the whole documentary and our family reunion in Greenville. And so a few years back, as part of the culmination of a lot of your work, you show the documentary of your work tracking back our history. And I'll let you get into that, but I wanted to pick up when you brought up mom. I gave you a few things I want to talk about, but this amazing footage that you showed me. So I got permission from mom to talk about this, because she says she's okay with it and that she's over it. But again, you know, the whole element of releasing people from a bondage, this footage allowed her, while you filming her, release herself of something. Okay?
Yeah.
So, you know, I want you to tell us about this experience, what you had with Mom, and set it up, and where you filmed her break a chain of fear in the former Big House, where she cooked, where her sisters cooked, where her mother cooked, and her grandmother cooked. And I think I can't give it justice by setting it up. I just want you to describe that whole moment when I saw on film. And, you know, it really combats this whole notion of, yeah, slavery and these things were done, get over it. It shouldn't change. But that told me right there were still scars. There's still some bondage. Can you talk about that?
That is the most life-changing moment for me probably ever. it was me, Kennard, and a couple of my film crew. I had Chris Battle and Jason Ebanks. We were down there. And Doris, your aunt, had said, and your mom, Sarah, had said that they would take us back to the Big House. And the game plan was just to take photographs on the outside of the house. We knew that the Carter family was still using it as a I think it was like a weekend retreat or something like that. Really, we were just going to do that. But there was cars parked next to the house. And so, you know, we thought we'd be polite and knock on the door and say, we're just going to take some photographs. And then we were met by a woman who's probably, I'd say, 10 years younger than me, Eleanor Carter, and she was there with her boyfriend, and they were having drinks. And she was, to give her credit, I think that they would have, if it were me, I probably would do, well, actually, I don't know what I would do, but anyhow, she opened the door, and here's this group full of black folks with video cameras saying, hey, we're researching our slave history. Can we take photographs? And she went one step further, and she brought us into the house. And she gave us a tour of the house. And it was this bizarre thing of, these Canadians walking through with video cameras, and the boyfriend, who was a lawyer, who was just kind of sitting in the corner, kind of looking at us all suspicious-like. Kennard was really great and engaged, and your mom and Sarah, or your mom and Doris were nervous, and your mom particularly was quite nervous. I couldn't figure out what it was. We'd walked through the house, and we had done the whole thing, and Doris was telling me stories about Joni O'Poole dying on the toilet. These crazy stories. And the way that they contrasted with the stories that Eleanor Carter told, which were, this is my childhood home, and I had slumber parties here. And it was just so apparent that she wasn't conscious, that she was talking to people that probably were making the beds that she was jumping on. Like, just, it didn't connect for her, or couldn't connect for her. Maybe it did after the fact, but in the moment, it wasn't what she was talking about. And we got to the very end of the tour, and we had gone through the kitchen, and the kitchen had been remodeled, and I remember your mom and Doris were talking about how things had changed throughout the house. And we were at the bottom of the stairwell, and your mom told a story about how ultimately we had done the whole thing that we had done. It was the first time that she's ever walked through the front door of the Big House. And then she started crying, and we all started crying. And it was this incredible moment. And the courage, your mom and Doris never told us that that's what it was for them. They just took us through. I remember Doris jangling her keys all the time.
Nervous.
Which, from a filmmaker's perspective, was driving me crazy. But I, in hindsight, I understand that that was her nervous.
Right.
And they kept it together, and they got us through that whole experience. And it was the most important moment. It continues to be one of the most important moments of my trips in the South. It blew my mind, and I was so thrilled and humbled that they
still here.
That was like 2006.
Right.
2006. I think your mom, I'm not going to say how old she was, but people that had lived a very full life, and it was the first time they had walked through that front door.
Sure, and even, you know, the whole element of seeing her walk over the threshold from the kitchen, and what you kind of understand is that the kitchen and most of the houses were on the outskirts. They positioned the kitchen on the corner or outside of the house just in case someone decided they want to burn down the house, they can actually quickly disconnect it. And so she had never really stepped over that threshold. And I saw that footage. Yeah. I could see just the spirit in her. She was just that nervousness. I can't believe she's doing this. And and that's what really moved me when you showed me that. So, wow, it was an absolutely amazing moment.
And they never let slip. And that's what I mean about the grace and the strength, is that they never let us know that that was what was blocking them or any of that stuff. What was in front of them was this documentary and this opportunity to make change and to tell a story, and that's the program that they stuck with, and they dealt with whatever internal stuff that they had to deal with on their own and helped us through that. I am deeply, deeply indebted to them for that moment.
Yeah, absolutely, so, absolutely. So let me switch the table on you a little bit. You know how I am, right?
It was going too easy.
Let's switch the table. You know the thing about it is, you know, and it's not to this story here. I just want to let you know this story is not to embarrass the current generation of the pool or the plantation family. It's not that, you know, because even to this day, our family has really an uncommon strong bond that we talk to them all the time, and great friends of these next generation. So I don't want to give that impression as we talk about this, right? But, you know, even beyond just, you know, for the family in our area, you've had some interesting encounters lately from descendants of the family across the country. And essentially, can you talk about a couple of those? And again, it's once again for me, it's releasing them from bondage.
I've been in correspondence. I haven't talked to the Carters who owned the plantation pre-Civil War. I haven't talked to them probably about 5 years, but we're still in good contact. I was getting Christmas cards for a while there. But lately, who have I been talking to? I've been talking to a woman named Stella Symington, who used to work for the Atlanta Constitution Journal as a writer. And she came to the event that I had been staged in Atlanta a couple of weeks ago. We had been corresponding for years. And I have to be honest, when I first met, when we first started writing, and she found me, and she was trying to figure out how to deal with her family history. She is, I believe, Joe Neal Poole's niece. I'm going to say she's, and I don't quote me on the family connection, but she's part of the Poole family, definitely spent her summers at the plantation. And she found me somehow, maybe from the first documentary I did about our family history, which is just the oral history part of how we're all related. And she found me, and I have to be honest, when she did first connect with me, I was really angry about the family history. And I didn't know how to deal with her. And so she came to me with the question of how do I deal with this history. And it upset me originally. I'm just thinking, why are you coming to me with this question? I'm trying to figure out my own family connection. And I admit, I spit back some bad comments about, you know, here, read a book about your horrible family history. I wasn't gracious.
You were not gracious.
But to her credit, she stuck it out, and we've continued to correspond over the years. Not as frequently as we used to, but we stay in touch. And white history, a difficult piece to do for the fact that it's raw. It's, you know, like I said, it's got a Klan rally recording in the middle of it. It's touchy stuff. And she came out, and she was lovely and gracious and attentive and, you know, we vowed that we're going to stay and connect again and just keep having this conversation about how you work through this history. I mean, the reality is she, what is her fault in this situation? She was born to people that weren't always great. And she was born into a very difficult family lineage. And at some point, you have to ask the question: when do you stop, or where do you stop penalizing people for stuff that's happened 100 years, 200 years ago, and acknowledge that these are people that are just like you and I, are trying to figure out how to get ahead, get beyond their past pains, and figure out how to be good people, right? So she's a really lovely example of this exchange that we've got going, and it's work for me to figure out how to engage with her. It's not like it's, you know, terribly difficult, but I do have to stop and think about, this is somebody, you know, in order for me to heal, I have to look at this person and say, this is somebody who's like me, that is doing something like I am. Different side of the coin,
right.
Maybe more privileged, maybe not. I don't really know her history. I don't know what's gone on for her for the last 40, 50 years. She could have had a lousy life for all I know. But at the end of the day, we're both doing this work of trying to come to terms with who we were born to and what we inherited.
So in the process, you have, you know, not only releasing us, people in our family, others, and also yourself, if you think about it. Now, just kind of think about, you know, the transformation you've gone through this process of going from being inquisitive to really having an understanding and anger, and now more of having your hands open, how do we move forward, right?
Yeah. And the other family member, and this is a newer one, that this is somebody younger than me. What's his name? Almond Pool. And again, he found the oral history that we had done, and it was an interesting way that he came around. I got this email out of the blue, and he emailed me to correct my genealogy,
okay.
Which I appreciated. It was cool, you know. And if there's anything I've learned about doing this history, Southerners are fantastic at writing their own histories, sometimes rewriting their own histories. So I appreciated that he wanted me to get it right, and that's totally cool. And then from there, really what we talked about was he had watched the video that I had done about our family migrating to Canada, and he said he was inspired. He was inspired, and I don't know if these are my words, but I got a sense that he was relieved that we were okay.
Sure,
you know?
Sure. Let's go to a break. Sorry to cut you off on that one, but that's an important point that we want to kind of bring home. So when we come back from the break, we'll pick that up. And stay with us. We still got a little bit more to go. Can't afford to continue to miss this rich history. So you're listening On Cue, and I'm your host, Eric Powell. We'll be right back. By getting them on cue with God's will, by getting them on cue with His calling on their lives. Let us help you get on cue.
How powerful is your leadership? Do people trust you? Would people follow you if you were not their boss, not their parent, not their sibling, not their commanding officer? Let us help you get on the queue.
I learned more about the heart of leadership than the arch of leadership. What Eric Powell does in this session is makes the leader in you come alive.
Do you know God has called you? Do you know your purpose? Let us help you get on cue.
It should be a mandatory part of every church pre-membership class, every school leadership program. I think this curriculum effectively used not only positions a person for better leadership, but positions a person for better life.
And we're back, and we're breaking some chains here with my cousin Deanna Bowen, our special guest. And you're listening to On Cue. I'm your host, Eric Powell. Thanks for staying with us. And you remember, our mission here is to get you on cue with God's will and His purpose, and equip leaders to lead where they are. And so, you know, before the break, we've been talking about really breaking the bondage of is from the mind, body, and spirit. And also, you know, been having our special guest, Deanna Bowen, who's been tracing our genealogy from our family, from Alabama to Texas to Oklahoma to Canada, and there and back. And, you know, through her work has really reconnected generations of people who have been disconnected. And so, you know, we've had reunions. We're up on our second reunion in Dallas, and now we're looking forward to having a reunion in Canada next year. So pretty exciting times. And not only the fact that her work has told a story of so we can reconnect ourselves with our history and really breaking bonds of just not knowing. But he's also helped people on the way on the other side who was part of the family or the side of the world that was really the oppressors. And so at the end of the day, though, you know, it's how do we come together? How do we be one another? How do we continue to break these cycles that hinder us from really being a rich people who are really looking after each other? And so you know, as we she told her few elements and stories today, but I really want to talk about you know, what's next for you, Deanna. You know, what is what are you trying? Of course, we already know what you're trying to do, but what's next for you, and what's driving all of that?
I've got a lot on the go. Today, I'm in a conference for Black artists and writers talking about creating dangerously, writing and creating art that's about Black Canadian history. I'm working with some historians, a collection of proper historians from Yale, Rutgers, a whole bunch of other places, and we're trying to write the next go-to, you know, school history book on Blacks in Canada, talking about, really, I think the last major history book that was written on Blacks in Canada was in 1970, so we're talking about a complete update. And how we're doing that is we're building off of family tree. So if there's anything, and I think I said this, I've been saying this for as long as we've been meeting as a family. If there's anything that I need everybody to do, it's to write down your family tree. It doesn't have to be anything serious. Put on a Bible, whatever you need to do. Write that down, because I can take that information to a historian who can do the research, and we could literally map how we move over time. And it matters. It matters. What I had said to you over the break was the best way to render a community or to erase a community, leave us, is to erase their history. Because then you're just wandering around lost. And I can say that in Canada for sure, that, you know, this is a place where we walk around this whole idea that there aren't a lot of Black people, all that kind of stuff, and it's just not true. So my job, what I'm doing, is trying to undo that. So I'm doing the history project, and then out of that, the historians, if we get the money, I'm going back to Oklahoma, and I'm going to be, researching lynching,
right,
of all things. But I do it because when we were talking about my great-grandfather, our family coming to Canada, the Oklahoma part is, on the American side of the coin, is the great missing link around Black American history. Where do those Black folks go? And so the Canadian side, us, we're the answer to that question. one, and then two, I want to have a conversation about what was really happening in Oklahoma. So what's interesting for me is, on the Canadian side, nobody talks about the fact that there was a lynching within a year before we left Oklahoma, and there was a lynching a year after.
Yeah.
And in fact, there were more lynchings in that 10-year period when we left than any other time. And so I'm going back to look at that. It's not easy work, but it's necessary work. It's the stuff that keeps us silent. It's the stuff that makes us look over our shoulders. It's the stuff that, you know, it's the stuff, quite honestly, that had my grandfather keeping rifles under his bed until he died. You know, I mean, it's that kind of, I'm looking at that history and the connections that it has to the way that we live our lives right now.
Right.
So I'm doing that. I'm doing a piece about my mom and I, and that's actually another reason why I started the work altogether, was just to make sense of her and I, and that's going to have me digging around in Oakland during the 1960s. So it's part history, part personal, part genealogy, and then maybe I might be going to Germany.
Sure,
start
sure.
Start talking about Black Germany.
Right. So where can people find you and your work, or contact you, if it's Facebook or a website?
I'm on Facebook. You can find me at deannabowen.ca. I just did a project in Atlanta, so you can check. You can do a search for that. Listen to me on. My videos are online on YouTube as well. That's about it, I guess. Everything's out there.
Yeah, absolutely, absolutely. You know,
family trees are on Ancestry.com.
Okay, great, great. So you know, I know that you know, you've allocated some time for us this morning. You got to get to your conference, but you know, just hold for a second. I really want to,
yeah.
Hey, thank you. Let you know we love you down here as always, and
I love you guys, and
really appreciate you taking the time. You know, but you know, in general though, you know, as we in the audience have heard, you know, our story gets richer and richer by the generation, and not just ours, but anybody, Black, white, whomever in America.
Yeah.
And you know, but when we're in Dallas, you know, even though, you know, for us, from a Canadian American family, you know, even though we're generations apart and strangers, but you know, for me, you know, what connected us to our Canadian family, you know, and, you know, as you heard, and there were so many differences, and there's so many different similarities as we discovered, you know, although we are divided geographically, Deanna's journey really kind of brought us together and showed our experiences were parallel. When I was in Dallas some time ago, as you think about it, what I call the societal ecosystem has really four pillars, you know, political, educational, economic, and social. You know, what I found listening there was at the reunion a few years back, you know, on the political pillar, you know, our Canadian brothers experienced struggles and racism, separations, just like our American brothers, you know, but that did not let things, you know, let things keep them in that bondage. Instead, you know, there's a journey up to freedom, you know, to get their eyes really due north on faith and God and family. You know, on the educational side of things, I heard similar stories again. You know, some made it to the sixth or eighth grade, you know, had to start working to support the family, walk miles to school in the snow, you know, but that didn't let things keep them in that bunch. Instead, they knew that the journey to, I heard someone quote and say, read and writing properly, because a new education was just true to overcoming that. And so you know, on that economic perspective, you know, hard working, hunting, and even from a social perspective, really it's about family, hope, and faith. It was protecting the family. So you know, it was so many different similarities. That's why we were able to gel together doing these reunions, because it started with faith, you know. And, you know, so how do we continue to manage those survivorships? So, you know, we're coming up on this reunion here in Canada. You know, why it works is because of those elements I talked about, faith and family. And it will forever connect us. And not only connect us from a Canadian and American family, but also, you know, our plantation family, that next generation. You know, so the question of the day, you know, are we leading people from bondage, bondage of the mind, bondage of the spirit, bondage of shame, bondage of unforgiveness, bondage of fear, of poverty, bondage of hopelessness, sorrow, or guilt? Ask yourself that. And so whenever you interact with others, release them from that bondage. Don't have this over their heads. And, oh, of course, there are some things that we need to heal. It starts with the healing. It really starts with understanding where those issues come from. But, you know, so today we've been blessed with sharing a part of our history, my history, American history, or, well, North American history, if you want to say that, Deanna. You know, and so I want to give thanks and honor to Christ Jesus, who's given me, given us this opportunity to really lead where we are. My special guest, Deanna Bowen, my cousin, who's really on a modern day Harriet Tubman, on a journey to uncover some of these.
Thank you to everyone who listened to this replay. I have an ask for all of you. Put us on your prayer list. Like us on Facebook at OnQ Radio. Follow us on Twitter at Q Leadership. Invite a friend to listen to this show and to next week's show. Consider Q Leadership curriculum and training for your home, church, or company. If you would like to be a sponsor, please email us at onq@qleadership.com. Thank you to everyone that came out to the huddle. We hope that you got everything you needed out of the program. We give all honor and praise to Christ Jesus, our Savior. Thanks to those who tuned in. I'm sure my dad thanks his producer, assistant me, his better half, best friend, and wife, my mom, my little sister, Carson, all of our family, friends in life, and on Facebook. This has been On Q Radio. Until next week.
How do you lead a people who are starved, who are broken, who are isolated?
We lead them where they are by getting them on cue with God's will, by getting them on cue with His calling on their lives. Let us help you get on cue.
How powerful is your leadership? Do people trust you? Would people follow you if you were not their boss, not their parent, not their sibling, not their commanding officer? Let us help you get on the queue. Let us help you get on cue.